Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowdrin. And for those of you who thought it couldn't be done, you thought I couldn't do it. I know who you are. You're out there doubting me. But guess what? I'm still here. On the show today, we're not going to just break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to discuss some of my top 100 of the 80s, going back to a time when I was doing some writing for Mr. Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer in his 1989 yearbook. I did the top 100 matches of the 80s, and I'm going to discuss a couple of those matches today on my show, and I'm going to be joined by my good friend, Mr. Barry Rose. Hey, Barry, what's going on?
Hey, it's all going great, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me on the debut show. Pretty exciting stuff. You know, when you called me and you said that you were going to be doing your own show, I was like, it's a natural Mr. Personality. So I'm excited. Thanks so much.
That's what all three of my wives call me, Mr. Personality. But so anyway, the genesis of the podcast, the idea for it on this episode was, as I said, I did a top 100, and I just went through with Barry and discussed a few of the matches that we had talked about. And so there's no place to start at the beginning. Hey, Mom, I've got a podcast. Whoa. We're going to start, first of all, and we're going to talk about whether or not these matches hold up and whether or not they're still as good as they were when I first watched them. And the first match we're going to start off with for my top 100 is Tiger Mask versus Dynamite Kid. Madison Square Garden, September 2nd, 1982. Barry, where were you in 82?
Where was I in 82? I think I was still floating around Miami Beach. I don't think things had changed. And I'm not sure that I actually saw this match until probably 3 or 4 years later when I was able to catch it on videotape.
Well, I have just, as a matter of fact, recently had a chance to rewatch the match. And one of the things that I have to say, this does not hold up, in my opinion. It's still a great match, lots of really unique spots, but one of the reasons I think that the match is so well remembered among fans, especially you know, old WWF fans, is because what they were doing at the time was completely revolutionary. Nobody in Madison Square Garden had seen the likes of Satoru Sayama and Tom Billington. I can definitely tell you that.
Yeah, and I too. So in going off of that, a really interesting note is when you look at the match in the beginning and you watch the introductions, the crowd is lukewarm at best. You know, there's a smattering of boos for the Dynamite Kid, a little bit of cheers for Tiger Mask. But for the most part, the fans had no idea who these two guys were. They were so enthralled with the match. And granted, this match doesn't hold up to their work in Japan when they wrestled each other. But if you watch this match and then watch the end, the fans are on their feet. They're clapping. They're cheering. They've never seen anything like this.
So no.
I agree with you.
It
doesn't hold up in the way that I think that this match was put on a pedestal. When you and I, you know, 25, 30 years ago, this match was really put on a pedestal, and it's a fantastic match. But at the same time, I think it was more the concept of such a revolutionary event taking place in MSG, where the matches traditionally were a lot slower, a lot more plodding. They weren't nearly as exciting or innovative. So to me, it's a fantastic match. Again, doesn't hold a candle to their work in Japan, though.
No, you know, I recall their match from April of 1983 that they had that was just fantastic. This was like, as you said, to the fans in Madison Square Garden, because as you start watching the match, you can see the people in Madison Square Garden thought this was the popcorn match. This was the match that was going to be, oh, okay, yep. Pedro Morales is coming up in a little bit, or Bob Backlund, so let's go get a soda and a popcorn and maybe a beer. And all of a sudden, you see the people literally 30 seconds of the match stop and go, what the heck is this? And they realized this was nothing they've ever seen before.
Yeah, when Tiger Mask 2 is doing these backflips off the top rope, and, you know, it's who else had done that in Madison Square Garden? You know, was Antonio Rocca doing that 25 years earlier, Edouard Carpentier? So to me, it was really innovative. And, you know, when you and I were going through these matches, I actually went back and I watched the entire match, and it really was so exciting. And I think one of the things I also look at when I look at a match like this is a guy like Billington, and I thought Sayama was fantastic. I mean, he was, again, nobody else was really doing in the U.S. what he was doing. But I look at a guy like Billington and I say, oh my God, could you imagine if he had worked the territory system? And I know he was in Calgary and I know he was in the Pacific Northwest, but if he had come through Florida or come through Georgia, just some of the matches he could have had with guys like Jack Briscoe, some real, real wrestlers. I thought he was fantastic.
Well, you know, one of the famous stories that I've always heard is the story that Joel Watts had seen videotapes of Dynamite and Davey Boy in Japan and had tried to talk his father into watching a videotape of the guys. And Bill Watts kept putting it off, finally saw a tape of the team and said, wow, these guys are really good. We need to get them in, and was going to bring them in and program them with the Midnight Express. I don't know if this is true, if it's a wrestling legend, but I've always heard this. And you can just imagine the possibility of the British Bulldogs facing off with the Midnight Express in Mid-South and the kind of matches that, you know, we could have ended up having from those four.
That would have been a dream, absolutely.
I also try to imagine Tom Billington working for Bill Watts, which is a completely different story. I'm not sure that would have worked out.
I don't think that would have worked out, but he really was incredible too. And you know, again, as good as Sayama was, which he was, to me, it's Dynamite Kid was the guy. And you know, once he got to the WWF, he was still having really good matches. But his stuff in Japan is mind-blowingly good. His stuff in Calgary, just unbelievably good. And you know, the thought of him in 1980 or 1981, starting to work the territory system, you know, whether it would have been Georgia, Florida, the Mid-Atlantic area, just really unbelievable. And he was such an incredible wrestler, and incredible, you know, and taking that, you believed him when you saw him wrestle.
Sure. And, you know, the one thing about Tom Billington that I will say is Tom Billington is definitely one of those people who is a generational talent. You know, they talk about how Tanahashi in Japan is a once-in-a-generation talent. Dynamite Kid, when he first began to get exposure in the United States and Japan, he's the kind of guy that when you saw him, you see where everyone else that came after him started with the Dynamite Kid. That's
correct.
That's how incredible he was. You know, everybody, you know, your Owen Harts, your Brian Pillmans, Chris Benoit's, everybody else in, you know, Japan, like Misawa, people like that, they're all, their baseline is Tom Billington.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. And I'm actually a Kawada fan. You left that name out.
No, so. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, but one thing about Tom Billington also brings up the argument. Tom Billington is a guy that I would compare, tell me what you think about this, to Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels, a generational talent, but they have something in common. And that is when they were both working and in their prime, they were also problems in the locker room so severe that both of them caused that you wonder, you know, if I could go back in time and have a guy that's that talented, do I really want him because of all the headaches he's going to cause in the locker room?
Yeah, it's a good point too. And when you first were bringing up that comparison of Shawn Michaels and Billington, I was like, where's it going to go with this? But yeah, you're right. Guys who had this negative effect and negative reputation within the locker room. And Shawn Michaels, obviously, it was a boon for Vince. He sold a lot of merchandise, was having really good matches, and there was a certain popularity that he had. I don't think Dynamite Kid was at the level. Well, Dynamite Kid as a wrestler was maybe 10 times what Shawn Michaels was, but at the same time, it really is all about drawing and making a lot of money.
Oh, no, yeah, of course. No, Shawn Michaels, I'm certainly in the ring. His talent, unquestionable. His ability to rise on the big shows, unquestionable. But then, you know, you also have to accept the fact that he was such a major headache for Vince that, and you wonder if Vince looked the other way or just sort of accepted it and said, it is what it is.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. And you know, there's that real famous story about the Dynamite Kid and Jacques Rougeau that's out there. And I'm sure at this point, everybody's heard that story numerous times. And I'm Facebook friends with Jacques Rougeau, and we were trading messages, and I was trying to set him up for an interview. And one of the things I asked him, I said, hey, can we talk about this, this incident with the Dynamite Kid? And it was radio silence after that. I never heard from him again. So I'm assuming he doesn't want to discuss it.
Probably not. Okay. Let's go to the second match I've picked out. Second match, Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat Baltimore, March 18th, 1989. This match is famous. It was taped by the George Michael Sports Machine for NBC, and it was very famous because in the Wrestling Observer, Dave Meltzer gave this 6 stars, which was completely unheard of at the time. Nowadays, of course, if you mention a match is 6 stars on Twitter, most people have a stroke and want to know why other matches aren't 6 stars. But I had a chance to watch this match recently. Great match. It's like watching two old dance partners, but it just kind of left me lacking. One thing I noticed in the match, and I want to get your thoughts on this, is you watch this match and other Ric Flair matches, you remember how great a referee Tommy Young was.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. Tommy Young really was a great referee. And when you say Flair versus Steamboat and you're talking about the quality of matches that they were having, it's almost like you got to put Tommy Young in there as well as the referee, because he was such an integral part of what they were doing. And he really had a way of adding to the match without subtracting from it, as sometimes referees can do. So Jeff, let me ask you a question. How would you rank the Flair-Steamboat matches in order? Between the big three and then this match that we're discussing right now?
Well, for me, obviously the number one choice is the match from Nashville, because that was my number one match of the decade. I'm a little bit different. I know a lot of people are really into the 2 out of 3 falls match from New Orleans. For me, that's 3, and number 2 would be Chicago. I like Chicago because the finish was such a sort of a middle finger to Dusty with the false ref bump. Just the difference that they took from what they were doing with Crockett to what they were doing now with, because TBS had just taken over the company. And to me, it was like watching two old dance partners go at it again. And they were just so perfect with one another. One thing that someone told me once is that in the very first match, the one from Chicago, that Flair was obviously the better performer because Steamboat was still getting his feet back from under him from the years, in the WWF. And then he had, taken about 6 months off after the birth of his son. And in the second match, they were kind of even. And in the third match, Steamboat was probably the better performer in the third match. That was just somebody's opinion that they told me once, and I kind of tend to agree with it. So I would say Nashville 1, Chicago 2, New Orleans 3. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I would probably agree with you. I mean, for me, the highlight's always going to be, watching these two guys. And I think saying dance partners is such a great analogy because they really were in tune and in step with each other. And these were arguably the best matches that we were seeing this year. And I would think anywhere. I know we can take out Japan, and it's a different style and stuff like that. But I think, as a wrestling fan, this might have been one of the last times that I was truly emotionally invested into a feud. It's very, very hard pressed for me to think in the last 25 years or whatever it's been at this point, almost 30 years of feuds where I get deeply invested that I've got to watch a match between them or I've got to read exactly what's going on. That doesn't really occur. And that really says something about everybody involved with the matches. I would say the highlight for me, and this is, I'm definitely biased and jaded on this fact, is when Terry Funk, pile drove Flair through the table. It was just such a big deal to me. I'm such a huge Terry Funk fan, and it kind of came out of the clear blue sky for me. It wasn't something that I was expecting. I don't know if any of us were expecting it at that point. So,
two things.
Just a great feud. Yeah.
Two things. Number one, the table was supposed to be gimmicked, and apparently forgot to gimmick the table.
Yeah.
And number two, Terry Funk, he said, "I'm not good enough." He kept repeating, yep. "He said, I'm not good enough." The thing that I always wondered is why didn't they, if they were going to shoot that angle, because, at the end, Flair and Steamboat sort of acknowledge each other. Steamboat, always classy, leaves the ring. They do the angle. I thought if they're going to have Flair out for a while selling the injury, they should have had Steamboat run back and do a run in. That way they could have naturally transitioned to Flair, to Steamboat and Funk. They could have had that headline a clash, lead into the Bash. I think that would have been a good way to transition Funk into a main event role as the main event heel for the company.
Yeah, and that's why you've earned the nickname the Booker as well, because you were always seeing three and four steps ahead of what they should have done. There was definitely a lot of missteps that were being made that year in WCW, and that being one of them right there, because it would have solidified Funk, and it would have kind of kept Ricky Steamboat going along that same path. And with Flair out, you needed somebody to do that. So I would agree with you on that. But for me, it was so exciting. You know, we hadn't seen Funk in quite a few years. He had that ill-fated run in the WWF, and he had bounced around indies. I'm sure he'd been in Japan, and he was part of the Florida Championship Wrestling promotion, feuding with Dustin Rhodes. But, for me, I think when I saw Terry there, I didn't for once think that he was going to be coming into WCW. So it was completely unexpected for me. And I just remember sitting on a couch or sitting in my living room, and all of a sudden it happens, and as you kept saying, I'm not good enough and all that, and I remember just popping out of my seat. And again, that probably hasn't happened in 20 or 30 years when I watch wrestling. So yeah, it was great. Just an amazing feud. And years ago I didn't have this particular match, but I had the three, and I had the triad on DVD, and I sat down with my son. So my son must have been 10 years old, 11 years old at the point, and I said, this may be the best, series of three matches in the U.S. That you'll ever see. And he sat there for over 2 hours and just watched and was completely enthralled by it and got it. And it's, that old adage, the old cliche, and it definitely is a cliche, is the human chess thing, and it really was. And just watching it move for move for move. And it was textbook perfect.
Well, and I think if you can, as you pointed out, if you can get the next generation to sit as 10 or 11 year olds and watch the match and be as compelled as we were when we first saw it live in our mid 20s, I mean, it speaks well to how well the series holds up. Before we go to our next match, a little bit of trivia. Barry, do you remember after Terry Funk had debuted, after he was established, they did this set of tapings at TBS Studios. Funk makes his first appearance as a heel. Who was his first opponent?
Oh, geez.
Squash match. He did a squash match against a young, upcoming wrestler named Eddie Guerrero.
Oh, really? Had no idea.
Look it up, folks. Look it up. I'm not just playing games here. Okay, third match. Ric Flair, Bruiser Brody, St. Louis, January 4th, 1985. I'll tell you what is amazing about this match is how absolutely crazy the fans are in St. Louis about Bruiser Brody. Oh, my God, was the guy over there.
Yeah, so you're right about that. When you look at that match, he was super over. But I'll tell you the real surprising thing for me in this match was this was a wrestling match. And, how many times do we see Bruiser Brody in a true wrestling match? It didn't happen that often. At least I didn't. Most of his feuds were against these guys like Abdullah or the Sheik or somebody like that. So I didn't get to see Bruiser Brody a lot in these pure wrestling matches. And this match against Flair, it's fantastic. Everybody says this, and this is nothing groundbreaking, but I mean, who couldn't Flair wrestle in the 80s and make him look good? And for Bruiser Brody to adapt to the Flair style, which is what he did, this wasn't the typical brawling Bruiser Brody. There are moments throughout, of course, but this was a wrestling match, and I thought it was fantastic.
No, this is a match where people that have never seen Bruiser Brody, this is a great introduction to Bruiser Brody. I mean, his stuff in Japan, of course, where he's the they called him the intelligent monster in Japan, because he would actually speak to the Japanese reporters. He would speak very slowly so they could understand him and take notes, which was something that not every American could do or would do. And that's one reason why the Japanese reporters and the fans appreciated Brody so much. But you see this match, and not to sound cliched or trite, but he's really wrestling Flair in this match. And, again, the emotion of the crowd, I can't stress enough just how invested the people in St. Louis are in the match. And I'll tell you what's really crazy is, as I look back on my top 100, 3 weeks later, Ric Flair is facing Kerry Von Erich in the Kiel. And he has another top 100 match. That was one heck of a month to be a fan of wrestling in St. Louis. Two top 100 matches within 1 month in the same venue.
Yeah, and you're right about that, too. And it really goes back to what I just said, too. Who couldn't Flair wrestle in the 1980s and have a great match with? And, we all hear about Flair and broomsticks and all that. But,
Or Mike Von Erich.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't put that in the top 100 match, but at the same time, yeah, that's one to throw out there, Mike Von Erich. But yeah, he really was that good, and you know, it's I think the criticism I've always heard of Flair, especially in the 1980s, was he's having the same match night after night, and that really wasn't true. You know, he was making guys wrestle his match. And when you look at the Bruiser Brody, that wasn't Brody's style of match. Even Kerry Von Erich, that wasn't truly Kerry's style. That was Flair's style, and he was adapting to it. So you're right, man. It was, you know, I had a discussion with my wife today, and we were talking about Houston and with the, you know, the floods that are going on just after Hurricane Harvey. And she said, was Houston ever a huge wrestling town? So I went through, you know, yeah, Houston in the 1960s through the 1980s under Paul Bosch was a huge wrestling town. And I said, Friday nights were really three cities in the U.S. And it was Houston, it was Atlanta, and it was St. Louis.
Yeah. And Bruiser Brody was just a megastar in Houston when he appeared there.
Yeah, he absolutely was. He was, I mean, Brody cut his teeth in Texas and just an absolute megastar what he did for the state of Texas. Absolutely.
And it's really interesting the way that he transformed himself from when he first started. I mean, back when he was working in Louisiana, back when he was working in Texas in the early days, he was really a large guy. And when he went up to New York and worked his program with Bruno, he was a massively thick guy. And then as the 80s came about, as he went to Japan, he really thinned himself down. He was at least 50 pounds lighter than he had been.
Yeah, he was. So he was pretty big when he was in Florida. We saw him in late 1975 and then the early part of 1976 as Frank the Hammer Goodish. And sure, he was a guy that was, when you looked at him, he was so physically impressive. And he had the distinction. He made his debut on television and squashed Rocky Johnson, who was the Florida champion and won the title on TV. And it's hard pressed for me to tell you that ever happened before or after. But, you know, literally that was his first match. Unfortunately, nothing much came of it. Within 4 or 5 months, he was gone and really didn't get the main event push that he should have gotten, at least in my opinion, that he should have gotten. A lot of money was being left on the table, but just physically impressive. And, you know, you go back and you look at his thighs, and granted, that probably came from years of football and college football, but his thighs were like the size of, like, you know, my dog. And my dog's 120 pounds. So just gigantic. The guy was an athlete for sure.
He was the barking bad boy. Okay, match number four, Midnight Express versus the Rock and Roll Express, April 1986 in Charlotte. I have to tell you right from the start, there are probably about 50 rock and roll midnight matches we could have put on this list because that feud was just so legendary. There was literally about a 3 or 4 year period where they were having great matches pretty much on a nightly basis.
Yeah, so, you know, the best analogy I can put forth with this is you talk about the Rock and Roll versus the Midnight. It's the tag team equation of Flair versus Steamboat. It's, you know, again, it would be almost impossible for these guys to have a bad match against each other. And it, you know, which match was the best? I think, you know, obviously this, in your opinion, was the best match that they had. These guys were just incredible. You know, as a wrestling fan, I remember the highlight for me on the TBS shows or even the syndicated shows going back to this era, you know, 86, 87, 88, was waiting to see the Midnight Express versus the Rock and Roll Express, or just even see it, you know, a Jim Cornette interview, and then to see the Midnight Express wrestle a squash match. So these guys just work so well together. And, you know, Ricky Morton was such an unbelievable talent. And I know that we're going to talk about Ricky in a little bit, so I may just even wait for that. But he was just such an unbelievable talent where he could have these matches with guys. And everything he did, in my opinion, was great. You know, his selling was just off the charts. He could make anybody look like $1 million. But even his comebacks were great, you know. And here was a guy that was maybe 190 pounds. You know, he was a small guy by the stature of the wrestlers that we were seeing back then. So,
well,
I think
I'll tell you a couple points that I want to make here. Number one, Ricky Morton was one of the three greatest baby faces that I've ever seen. Ricky Morton, Barry Windham, and Ricky Steamboat. And when I say baby faces, I don't mean like Hulk Hogan was a baby face. I mean, in the ring, working a match, the ability to draw sympathy and empathy from the crowd. Those three guys are at the top of my list. And the other thing I'll have to tell you is people don't realize just how over that the team was over, but the way Ricky Morton was over and the girls, you watch the intro to this match. Jim and the boys are in the ring already and they cue the ELO music, Rock and Roll is King. And they start down the aisle and it's like, I'm trying to like if you would hear Justin Bieber about 5 years ago, come out to an audience of girls, the way they reacted, that's the way these people were reacting to Ricky Morton coming out. And they liked Robert Gibson, but they were reacting to Ricky Morton. These teenage girls were crazy about Ricky Morton. That's how over he was, just like nothing you can ever imagine. It's completely different than the way that, say, Hulk Hogan was over, or The Rock was over, or Stone Cold. He was over to a particular portion of the audience, the teenage girls, and he put asses in the seats. You got to give him that.
Yeah, and I would have to agree with that. And I want to say, didn't I read something at some point, too, where they said that Ricky Morton was selling more merchandise than Dusty Rhodes at this point also?
And I think it made Dusty crazy.
Yeah, I think it did. I think you're 100% right. But he was such a strong baby face. And he did, he did everything right. Just such an amazing team. And it's kind of cool to see that they're still out there. He's 60 years old, but Rock and Roll Express is still out there doing their thing.
And he's still got the hairdo.
We can talk about that too, but he still does
the
have the hairdo.
The mullet will never die as long as Ricky Morton is alive. Okay,
yeah.
Fifth match, Terry Gordy versus Killer Khan. We're talking November 22nd, 1984 in Dallas. Kerry Von Erich as the special referee. A complete bloodbath, old school brawl. Couple things about this match that I thought were interesting. Number one, this was something that was not being done in world class at this point. You had the Von Erichs and Freebirds, very little blood at this point in world class. And so this match was a complete dichotomy for what they were used to seeing. Now, as the match goes on, a couple things that are interesting for me to remember here after I just watched the match today. Number one is Gordy and Khan are working this tremendous brawl, just knocking the stew out of one another. Kerry Von Erich is working the ref, gimmick. Bill Mercer on the call. Bill Mercer is an announcer that I wish more people would remember just how wonderfully bad Bill Mercer was. Bill Mercer, during the match, brings up that Kerry has regained the American title and his challenge to Ric Flair has been enhanced. And Ric Flair, the next time he comes into town, he's going to have to face Kerry, by God. And let me tell you, he's completely ignoring the match. And it's this tremendous match going on in the ring.
Yeah, Bill Mercer was absolutely horrific, and I've heard he's the nicest guy in the face of the earth, and he's still alive, and I want to say 90 years old or close to being 90 years old, but he really was terrible, and there was that great line, was it the Barbarian?
Or the Barbarian.
From Norwegia?
Norwegia.
So, it's great to see that he came prepared and did a little bit of homework. And he always came across to me as like this old, nice grandfather type, but had no business being out there. But two things stand out about this match for me, and they're both Terry Gordy related. So the first is the amount of blood that Terry Gordy is covered in this match. I mean, he hit a gusher because he is covered in blood. The second thing is, has anybody ever thrown a better punch than Terry Gordy? Because when you look at the punches, and Jerry Lawler's great, it's a different style of punch, but when he starts to throw these punches and I'm watching them and I'm feeling these punches, it's absolutely incredible the way he's laying them in. And to Khan's credit, he's selling every single one of these punches. And there was a spot, and this was probably 4 years later, maybe, but in the UWF, and I know that you and I, we've talked Mid-South and UWF, for days, but there was this one where the Fantastics came in the ring and Gordy started laying both guys out with his punches, and it's a thing of beauty. Gordy must have thrown the best punch in professional wrestling, at least in my opinion, but just a great match, and, and I think I understand having Kerry Von Erich as the referee, but does it really make sense to have a shirtless Kerry Von Erich as the referee?
Well, first of all, I'd like to know if he was getting David Manning money that night. I doubt it seriously.
Right.
A couple other things. Number one is when Bill Mercer at ringside is calling the match. One of the things, you know, you were talking about, he's this nice grandpa that kept making mistakes and didn't do his research. He actually is discussing people that are coming into the territory. He mentions Billy Jack, this famous wrestler from the Pacific Northwest. And then he says, there's this new tag team coming into the area, the Midnight Express. And they're managed, and this is what he said, by Jim Corbett. And then he catches himself and goes, what? Huh? Oh, I'm sorry, Jim Cornette. He didn't even get his name right. That's when we should have known that Jimmy and the guys were doomed in World Class.
Yeah, to me, it just they weren't the right fit to be in World Class. But so this brings up a question, and this is something great. I don't know if you and I have ever discussed this before, but so who was the worst wrestling announcer of all time? I know who I think, but who do you think?
Well, you know, there's guys that are bad wrestling announcers, but you love them for the fact they're bad. You know, one of the, you know, on the 605 podcast, they love Larry Nelson for all his faux pas and his over, you know, eagerness. And Vince, a lot of people hated. I loved Vince as an announcer because he was so over the top. You know, I guess you could probably go with maybe David Crockett, who was also a little bit too eager to, you know, for the baby faces to beat the heels. Who do you have in mind?
Ed Whalen. So Ed Whalen was the absolute at a completely different level. And I think part of it was this holier than thou, I'm tougher than you, and I'll never back down from you attitude that he had. And the complete antithesis of what a wrestling announcer should be. So I can watch Calgary, but when I watch him, I sometimes get really angry. And I'm like, somebody should go out there and, you know, slap him around. And I understand why he was there. He was the connection to the TV and all that. But at the same time, I think he actually killed a lot of what was a fantastic product from an in-ring standpoint. That wrestling in Calgary was just tremendous. But his announcing really brought it down several notches.
Well, you know, and certainly one thing that you can say, no matter what you think of David Crockett or Gorilla Monsoon or Vince or anybody else, Bill Mercer, Joel Lawrence, they never purposely tried to sabotage an angle. And Ed Whalen did that. Ed Whalen instructed the cameraman, don't show that stuff in the ring. That's garbage. You know, put the camera on me because I don't want the fans to think that. And I can't even imagine if you're the booker in the locker room and you're watching the angle. Oh, well, this isn't getting on TV because our TV announcer doesn't like it. I mean, what kind of insanity is that? So, yes, definitely Ed Whalen, pretty much hands down, is in a category all to his own self.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay, so last match we're going to discuss on today's show. Eddie Gilbert, Ricky Morton versus Atusha Onita and Masa Fuchi, 1981, Tupelo Concession Stand, Part 2.
Okay, so Part 2 is better than the first Tupelo Concession Stand brawl that took place.
Which was also great.
The first time you saw that, too, you went, oh, my God, this is absolutely incredible. And then this was done. I remember the UWF did it years later where they did the Battle of New Orleans.
Which will also be talked about in future episodes.
Yeah, and I absolutely love that match because I actually like the participants in that match. But this match is so good, and it's again, this goes back to Ricky Morton. This is Ricky Morton pre-Rock and Roll Express days, and he was so good. He was such a house of fire, and when I watch this match, and arguably really one of my favorite matches of all time, it's super stiff. I mean, there's parts where Fuchi is laying him in with a 2x4 on Morton and Gilbert. He's laying in the 2x4. He isn't pulling this back. So these guys are really, really going into it. And I like the fact that Ricky Morton's father is the referee trying to separate them and break it up.
No one ever questioned that Paul Morton refereed his son's matches. Like, how did Jimmy Hart not make that an issue?
How does anybody not make that an issue? And granted, you had enough referees there. Why does Paul Morton have to referee his son's matches? You had Jerry Calhoun. You had some other guys. You could have put them out there. But super, super stiff. But I honestly think when I look at this match, and you and I have talked about Tojo Yamamoto before, and, you know, it's really hard for me to buy Tojo as this menacing, mean heel. Granted, it does work here. Because Tojo does a good job, everybody's covered in blood. But the funniest part is when he gets into the slap fight with the concession stand owner's wife.
Yeah, and what happens, for those of you that have never seen it, they're in the concession stand. the four main participants have sort of been thrown over the counter, and it's just Tojo covered in blood and mustard, and the guy that owns the concession stand, who may or may not have been in on the angle, comes over and approaches Tojo. Tojo begins giving him the Tojo chops. The guy goes down. The guy's wife, who also helps run the concession stand, comes running up to Tojo and starts slapping at him, "Get away from my husband." And then Tojo starts hitting her. And the old lady completely loses her mind and freaks out. As you know, it was just something that truly had to be seen.
You really do have to see it. And this is the beauty of the age that we live in, that you can go on YouTube and pull any of these matches up. And it's highly recommended to do that. But so Tojo's got the guy, and I want to say his name was Herman, because I'm pretty sure that either Lance or Dave called him Herman. So he's down on the ground, and Tojo's standing over him, and he's got him by, like, the collar of his shirt, and he's slapping him. But this guy Herman is putting up his hand to block the slaps. But it's almost like Tojo's trying to tell him, this is part of the show. This is what we do. It's really funny. But then the wife comes out, and they start, and Tojo's chopping and slapping her, and she's slapping him back. But it's like a third grade slap fight. Like, it's really bizarre.
But then it's like she's no selling Tojo's punch.
She's no selling. But then Tojo is no-selling her, so they're going back and forth with this, and then she puts her hands over her face like, oh, my God, and then she starts running around the concession stand, and of course, the first thing I notice, she's not wearing any shoes. She's back there serving food. There's no shoes on. So this is a match that I just think has to be seen. To me, it's out of all these concession stand brawls, it's the best one. But the beauty of it is, we're talking about it 36 years later. This holds up. This 100% is still just as good today as it was 36 years ago.
Yeah, and a couple other things that have to be mentioned. The guys begin throwing mustard on each other, okay? And so at some point, I believe it's Fucci cuts his ear, okay? So he's bleeding from the exterior of his ear, and mustard gets on his ear. And he just begins, the only word I can use, yelping in pain from the mustard getting inside his cut. There's so much going on. And then another part that people don't mention is how great it is, because Lance Russell is calling the actions from right on the other side of the concession stand. But as he's doing it, he's talking to his producer, and he's going, it's okay, we'll edit this stuff out in post-production. No one will know, which gives it a more realistic feel. And then he's like, Randy, my microphone is wrapped around the table leg. See if you can and it gives it so much of a more spontaneous feel. And it just adds to how great the match is. And that's why this is, of the matches I've listed, this one's in my top 20. And this one definitely holds up. This is what, not to sound elitist here, some of the matches you see, like in ECW, in the promotions over in Japan, FMW, Wing, the garbage you see on the indie circuit, for the last 15, 20 years, this is what they try to be, but this is what they can't be, because nothing I've seen since then is there have been some great brawls in Memphis. Trust me, I have a match in Memphis that's a brawl that's even higher on my list. But this, as far as one of those old school Memphis brawls, was just about as good as it gets.
Yeah, and so everything you just said is 100% correct. And it's some sort of magic that occurred with this as well, because you can't recreate this. You know, you can, as you mentioned, you can try to recreate this, but you can't. And it works on so many levels. It's this guy Herman on the floor. It's the barefoot wife and the slap fight. It's the mustard. And Dave or Lance also has this comment that, you know, Fucci's bleeding from the ear and Morton's bleeding from his eyes. And they're saying, like, you know, all these outrageous things, you know, and everybody's covered in blood. But it's such complete pandemonium for almost 15 minutes. And actually a guy that we haven't even mentioned once, who was the other baby face, which is Eddie Gilbert, a young Eddie Gilbert. I want to say 2 years in the business. He had, you know, in such a high profile match, but you look at it and they really are laying these out. You know, a lot of these shots were stiff. Some of these punches that Ricky Morton was throwing, I mean, just they look really, really stiff. So there is an air of believability when you see this match. And I think it's the best of all the brawls that took place, and highly recommended. I'll say it's one of my favorite matches maybe ever.
Okay, two things to finish up on this match. Number one, what's really interesting is, you know, of course, Onita would go on to form his own promotion in Japan, where they would wrestle these kind of style matches. That's what Onita was famous for. But what's funny is Masafuchi would go back to work for All Japan, middle of the card, you know, like performer, solid as the day is long, but he never wrestled these kind of matches again. He just went back to being a very traditional All Japan mid-80s guy. You know, he was fairly colorless, but you would watch his match and afterwards you would go, yeah, that was a good match. He never disappointed. He never had a match this good again, but he was a guy that you could count on every single night that you would see him for having a good match. The other thing, and this is something that Barry and I had discussed before we began taping, is how unique to the Memphis area that Tojo Yamamoto was. And the guy we compared him to was Mad Dog Vachon in Minneapolis and Montreal. When these guys went anywhere else, think about Mad Dog Vachon went down to Georgia, didn't mean a thing, went to the WWF, he was pretty much after his prime, didn't mean a thing. Tojo Yamamoto could never have gotten over anywhere else the way that he did in Memphis, where the fans really thought this guy, who was 5'2", maybe 160 pounds, they thought he was a killer.
Yeah, so you're 100% right with that, too. And actually, Memphis had another guy like that, which is Roughhouse Fargo, referee Sonny Fargo. So here was a guy that was in his 50s. He looked like he was in his 60s. And his gimmick was that he would come show up every so often whenever Jackie Fargo needed him, and he had just been released from the mental hospital. And he was this old grandfatherly type, and his name was Roughhouse Fargo, but they would call him Nuthouse Fargo. And you couldn't have taken him and put him in Georgia or Florida. You know, it only worked in Memphis. And Tojo was one of these guys, too, that just like Mad Dog, which you and I have talked about, that, you know, Tojo looked like somebody's grandfather. He was 5'2", 5'3", didn't really weigh a whole lot. You know, he would do these chops. There's nothing behind these chops, yet guys would sell for him. But this brings up an interesting question for me. And whenever I think of Tojo, there's always one thing I think of, and it's Tojo getting the win over Randy Savage before Randy Savage went to the WWF, and then them playing that match week after week in burying Randy Savage. So,
I can't make Randy look very good.
No, I'm sure Randy wasn't happy. And, you know, look, it's part of the business, at least it was in those days. And guys knew that if they were leaving a territory, you had to do the job. And I don't think anybody had an issue with that. And when I watched Tojo versus Randy Savage, it makes no sense to me. But in the context of leaving the territory, I get it. But on that note, Bill Watts was another guy that would bury talent when the talent left the territory. And I remember the whole Gary Young Chavo Guerrero feud, if you remember that from 87 from UWF. And granted, Watts did this, he buried JYD, but I remember Gary Young doing this interview and he would be like, I'm the guy that should have won the Rookie of the Year award, and I'm the guy that ran Chavo Guerrero out of town. And whenever he said that, either Watts or Jim Ross would go, yeah, I'll give that to you. You did run Chavo Guerrero out of town. So it was like this burial of when a guy left. And, you know, with JYD, I get he was your top star. He left to go make a lot of money. But what would you really intentionally try to bury a guy like Randy Savage when Randy Savage was leaving a territory where he's making 7,500 bucks a night and actually going to go make a fantastic living? So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, famously Vince, when a guy would come into the WWF, would book that match that was a quote unquote dark match, but that he would tape, where he would have the guy that just came in lose so that, you know, if they ever decided they want to skip town, they have that match on tape where, you know, if the guy walked out on Vince, all of a sudden that match would pop up on his TV tapings. So I don't think this was a completely unheard of thing to do. Granted, it's not really a really nice thing for a promoter to do, but we're talking about wrestling promoters who have a heart that's about as black as they come.
Yeah, to me it's different when, and I get the Vince aspect, but a place like Memphis, again, you're not making any money there. You know, nobody's, except for Lawler and Jarrett, really nobody else is going to get super rich there. So, you know, if a guy decides to leave the territory because he's going to go make 5 or 10 times more, which is, I'm assuming, what Savage did, how do you bury a guy like that? Because I remember they would show this match all the time to try to get Tojo over, or, you know. Yeah. Or at the very least, just try to continue the burial of Randy Savage. So it struck me as really odd.
So, okay, now let's go in a different direction. One of the things I want to do on the podcast here, like I said, that we're not going to just talk wrestling here, although wrestling is our first love here on the podcast. We're also going to talk about stuff like music, movies, television, pop culture. One of the things I want to do is I want to talk about our movie of the week. Brian Last over at the 605 podcast has his book of the week. We have our movie of the week, our movie of the week that Barry and I started talking about yesterday. That is a must see. We're not saying this is, you know, Citizen Kane. We're not saying this is some Fellini film. We're talking Rodney Dangerfield, and Easy Money. Barry, how gold was this movie?
This movie is so gold that I can literally put this on my television on an endless loop 24 hours a day and watch it, because every scene there is something in there. And people always talk about Rodney Dangerfield, and Back to School is probably the movie that comes up. But Easy Money to me, Joe Pesci, just incredible. Just an incredible chemistry with Joe Pesci. And I love all the characters. The son-in-law, Julio, can I call you Dad? Just, it cracks me up every time.
Well, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, as the neurotic daughter who speaks with this Jersey accent that you never hear in any other Jennifer Jason Leigh movie. It's just awesome.
Yeah, it really is too. And everything about this movie works. It's there's not a lot of money behind it. It's not slick. And I think you and I even said part of the charm of the movie is that it's slightly amateurish. You know, it's Joe Pesci. It's one of his first movies. He wasn't a big star or a big name at this point. But I'll tell you, the girl I really think is funny in the movie is the other daughter.
Yes,
Melinda.
The one that's keeping score. Yeah.
She's so funny. She's keeping score. She's so funny. She's so sassy. She's got this chip on her shoulder, and she's a young kid. She's probably 7, 8, 9 years old. But do you know what ever happened to her? Because I Googled this and I found out. Do you have any idea?
I'm guessing you are talking about an actress named Lily Hayden.
Boy, you're good.
It helps to have the IMDb site right next to you. But yeah, no. What happened to her?
So she became a world-class rock violinist and composer. And there's a scene in the movie where she's actually playing the violin. I don't know if you remember that. And she's playing the violin, but she retired from acting, and she's a rock violinist. She writes her own stuff, and she's world famous for doing that. She's been out of acting for years, but I thought she was great. But I thought everybody was great in the movie. I mean, Taylor Negron, who played Julio, which is Jennifer Jason Leigh's fiance and then husband.
He was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High as the pizza guy.
The pizza guy. And here's a guy that, you know, Taylor Negron was probably in back in the 80s. He was in like 60% of the movies made in the 80s, especially if they were comedies. So he was in a lot of movies, and he just passed away a year or two ago. He was a guy that was real social and real active on Facebook. And, I remember I asked him a few questions about Fast Times and and he was always responsive and always had pleasant things to say, but he was really funny. And there's just, you know, the scene, and you and I were talking about this one scene, which I still laugh every time, is when they get the wedding cake in the back of the plumbing van.
Sure. Hey, don't worry. I got the toilet blocking it in.
I mean, that's genius. And then he's like, you shouldn't be driving when you're drunk. I drive better when I'm drunk. And they're smoking joints. And a minute later, they're laughing. They're all over the road. It is just such a funny movie. And I do think it's Dangerfield's
best. And then there's the go home for that particular movie scene, which is just classic. And then, I'll tell you another great guy, a guy that sort of came to a unsavory end in Hollywood is Jeffrey Jones, who played the store manager, who always, he was also I believe he was the principal in Ferris Bueller.
Yes,
he's one of those guys. He was great in the Yeah, that. He was in HBO's Deadwood. He played the guy that ran the newspaper. Tremendous actor who apparently had a pretty sordid life. But in this movie, he is so great playing the sleazy department store manager who's trying to get in the good graces of the rich old woman. And he's one of those guys that every time you see him on the screen, he was terrific.
Yeah, he's most well known for being the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This is William Peterson. That whole scene, which is just incredible when he realizes he's not talking to Ferris Bueller. So just a great actor. And you mentioned that unsavory stuff. And that was an issue that occurred with, I don't know if it was child porn, but it was something. And Pee Wee Herman was involved.
It was not good
either. Yeah. And I don't think he did any jail time over it, but there was something to it that just wasn't good. And at the same time, it does appear that his career is kind of stalled now. But he's another one. You go back to the 80s, and I just mentioned Beetlejuice. He worked with Tim Burton a lot. And, you know, he worked with a lot of people, and he was always a bad guy. He never a baby face that I recall. And a lot of people get him confused with an actor named William Atherton, who was the guy in Ghostbusters, and he was in a movie called Real Genius. And,
yes, I know who you're talking about.
And also Biodome. And similar look, kind of a pasty-faced, red-headed, thin guy. So very, very similar look, but just a solid actor. But easy money to me. You know, if it's on cable tonight, I'm watching it.
Well, and here's one of the things that we talked about where you made a good point was you compare Easy Money to Back to School. Man, they're both great movies. But Back to School is like got the budget. It's more slick. Easy Money is like dirty down and dirty Rodney. And that's the best. You know, I mean, you think about how many times was that guy in Carson and just absolutely slayed, you know, like he came on there and would just have, you know, he was like Rickles on the roast in the 70s. You know, you were guaranteed a great performance every time Rodney showed up on Johnny Carson's show. And the Easy Money Rodney to me is Rodney, like, you know, cause he's just 2 hours. He's riffing, you know, hey, I get no respect.
That's all it is.
And, you know, and it's better as good as Back to School is, and it's a great movie. It's better in Easy Money. So we want to highly recommend that. Now, that being said, we're going to wrap things up. I would like to just point out, if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can reach me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. My book, Breaking Kayfabe, available at Crowbar Press. By the way, let me just say this. First of all, I want to thank my friend Scott Teal. You know, when I did the foreword for my book, Breaking Kayfabe, I thanked a lot of people that had been a part of my journey to become a writer and get my first book done. I forgot one particular person. Barry, any idea from you who I might have forgot?
Yeah, the guy who played the son-in-law in Easy Money, Taylor Negron. You didn't mention him.
No, that was a good guess. But my old friend Barry Rose, the guy who put me in touch with the publisher. And I forgot to mention Barry in the foreword. So here on a public forum with the millions and millions, no doubt listening, Barry, thanks for all the help. Thanks for helping me get my book published and for all my the help on the Facebook page. Salute. So that's from me to you. I'd also like to thank my good friend Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And I will say for now, this is Jeff Bowdrin, and we will see you next time on Breaking Kayfabe.